Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. We are joined today by Ramona Prasad, one of Fidelity's global and U.S. dividend portfolio managers based out of Boston. Ramona and host Pamela Ritchie discuss the effects of recent vaccine news on the markets. Also, Ramona shares her outlook on investing through her global perspective and details her thoughts on dividend investing and where investors can find income in the markets today. Ramona points out that she's been finding investing in Europe attractive of late, specifically in the UK, as well as many emerging markets, now that we're at a point where the rest of the world is a lot cheaper than the US, which has outperformed for many years. Today's podcast was recorded on November 18th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Ramona, a very warm welcome. Great to see you again.
Hi, Pamela. You too.
Ramona, I know from other discussions with you that you have a great interest in science. It's actually part of your background, your education. And you had such an interest in the development of the vaccine. What do you think now?
So the science part of the current problem we're trying to solve is really interesting to me. But also just from in terms of being an investor, I think it gave us a lot of investment edge. So we are really lucky to have a large and very capable research team, but specifically to have a healthcare team that is just excellent. So we've got a few PhDs on our team in different scientific disciplines who were able to help us, and especially people like me who are extra interested in the mechanics, to help us understand the treatment regimens, the therapeutics, the vaccine mechanics, just how vaccines work, all of the different vectors and modalities of vaccines. So it was both interesting, but it also gave me, I think, an investment edge in terms of trying to position throughout the year for an eventual solution to the pandemic, and therefore the potential for a global recovery coming out of the pandemic.
What do you think of the deployment of the execution, so-called, all these different pieces coming together? Is that where we look to next? Do we sort of take some comfort in the vaccine and now we look to how it unfolds?
Well, the market is certainly saying yes to that. You saw how the market behaved beginning of last week, and then throughout this week, economically sensitive, sectors, industries, stocks are doing much better. And specifically, the stuff going into the vaccine news was very constructive for economic sensitivity in that valuation dispersion, which is essentially a measure of fear. The valuation dispersion between, say, momentum and what I like to call anti-momentum or negative momentum, which I measure constantly, and I measure lots of different types of dispersion, but that one in particular, even more so than value and growth, that dispersion, particularly mo versus anti-mo, was extremely wide going into positive valuation news. And so that helped to explain sort of that very violent rotation that we saw at the beginning of last week that's sort of continuing now.
Well, it's interesting that you sort of talk about the preparation for that, because I think there were a lot of people in the market who were not prepared for that. Or that's the sense that you get, that there's a lot of sort of momentum moves that got a bit interrupted in a sense.
Yeah, I guess you could argue, if you had to try to measure preparation based on that valuation dispersion. So the way that I measured it was, momentum is a tricky thing to measure, but there are lots of standard ways to do it. So I took sort of everything that would count as positive momentum and everything that would count as negative momentum and essentially put a valuation on both of those buckets and looked at it back through time. And if you put the most economically cyclical valuation, such as price to book, on those two buckets and you look at it over time and you sort of normalize it, you would just see this extremely wide spread. And so based on the width, if you will, the amplitude or whatever of that dispersion, you could have argued going into the vaccine news that a lot of the market was not prepared, to your point. But I guess for me, just thinking about how to position throughout this year, it's been all about flexibility. So the expansion and contraction of valuation dispersion, or another way to say that, the sort of hope, the cycles of hope and fear have been more extreme this year than in the past few years. So you see valuation dispersion sort of gap out widely and then contract again. And my investment style is when it gaps out, when fear goes really high, you have to really consider what opportunities are in the market. And so that's what I've been trying to do throughout the year.
When you look around the world, where you've seen exactly those dispersions, where opportunities have been, there's obviously the U.S. focus. There's also other parts around the world. Can you give us a little bit of the lay of the land from your global perspective?
Sure. To do that, I'll just go backward a little bit in order to talk about going forward. So the U.S. market has just outperformed the rest of the world for a very long time. And so the valuation dispersion, again, the measure of sort of interest in the U.S. versus disinterest in the rest of the world has been and continues to be really wide. And it turns out that was justified because the fundamentals in the U.S. were better than most of the rest of the world. So we're at a point today, given that dispersion in valuations, the rest of the world is a lot cheaper than the U.S., where we again have to decide, does it make sense to kind of allocate regionally in a different way? And if you believe, as I do, in a global recovery based on sort of science having solved or solving at an accelerating pace, solving the current problem that we're grappling with, then to me, it makes a lot of sense to rotate out of the US and into other parts of the world. So you have valuation on your side and you have fundamentals on your side. And that was what was not the case for all those years that the US was outperforming. Fundamentals were not as much on your side. And so in a recovery scenario, stuff that's riskier, which is ex-US, tends to do better. So I've been finding over the last several months many more ideas in Europe, specifically in the UK, but also continental Europe, cross sectors, so economically sensitive sectors, as well as in emerging markets. And we've talked a lot throughout the years. I tend to not have a lot of stuff in the emerging markets. They don't tend to be high quality. I don't get a lot of income from them. But recently, I'm finding just many more names across ASEAN and Southeast Asia, all of these places in emerging markets. So it's been really fun just digging up ideas.
It sounds absolutely fascinating. Can you also tell us a little bit about some of the dividend, the health of dividends? You know, it's always a question because it's been rough for a lot of more defensive names. Have there been any rocking of the boats of dividends that investors need to know about or that you're noticing that you can share?
So, you know, through the pandemic, as either cut or suspended dividends, it was unclear whether the market was truly punishing them for that cut or suspension, or it was hard to really disaggregate performance. And what I mean by that, was the underperformance based on the cut or suspension, or was it based on the sectors they were in? So by and large, the what I call reliability sectors, staples and utilities and healthcare, you didn't have as many cuts as you did in obviously economically sensitive sectors, financials, discretionary, all of these things. So I actually looked at this as an income person. I wanted to know, to try to disaggregate, was the underperformance based on sector or based on the dividend cut? And the answer is actually very unclear. So what that tells me is that it's possible the market was looking through the cut. And certainly the work that we did shows that it to some extent was looking through suspensions, because it understands that the problem we have sort of has a solution. We'll get to the other side of it and dividends will come back. And it's really encouraging to me that some of the worst quality, most sort of fragile or vulnerable companies in, say, consumer discretionary in the U.S. have just started to reintroduce dividends. So they're already bringing them back, which is quite interesting.
And versus Europe, for instance, I mean, bars and restaurants and everything to do with eating and entertaining obviously is being curtailed, but was maybe less curtailed than Europe at some point. And can you just talk about the timing? Europe seems to be a few weeks ahead of us on a lot of things. Does that work on the sort of stock picking side of things as well?
you know, maybe earlier in the year when we were in like wave one that nobody understood, that was so scary because it was so big and so new. I think this idea of containment or mitigation or lockdown, whatever you want to call it, was very scary because it was hard to understand how it would work. By the time we got to wave two, there was some fear. And so valuation dispersions gapped out again, and that gave us an opportunity to invest. We're now sort of in wave three. I honestly don't think the market cares that much. After the vaccine news came out, it happened to be concurrent with, you know, this wave three, certainly cases just being really high. The market isn't really responding to that much anymore. Right. And that's because what I think is really important. So there is a hyper focus, certainly in the media, on cases, which is frequency. And what I learned from covering financials in the global financial crisis is frequency matters. Severity matters perhaps even more. Severity is outcome. And so what has happened in each subsequent wave is that the severity has gotten better. And you see that in the data for this wave as well, this third wave. It was unclear. And the second wave was a little bit scarier because we didn't know how severity would work. And so the way you measure severity is in hospitalizations and mortality. And if you actually chart that over time on a time series and you look back and you log it and all this stuff, it's actually a lot better. And that's for three reasons. One, we've all learned. So humans are learning creatures. We've learned how to deal with this. So by the time you get to the end of it, you know a lot more. Number two, there's a demographic mix shift, it looks like. So depending on if you can get the data, the cases are happening in healthier countries, which makes sense. As a virus rips through the population, it hits the most susceptible first, and it keeps going to the places of susceptibility. And as a result, to some extent, it gets weaker. So there's a mix shift towards healthier people. And then number three, the treatment regimens have gotten better. So the neutralizing antibody cocktails like from Regeneron are really effective. So by the time you get it, you can get better a lot sooner. Hospitalization rates are down if you get treated early. So I think the market to some extent understands all of that and sort of looks through it. So that was sort of the sciencey stuff that we were doing with our team to try to understand how subsequent waves would work. And I just decided that severity is what matters. Severity is okay. So I can actually invest really hard for the other side.
Interesting. So has it been a very big trading year for you? I mean, the year is not finished and there's more to go. But has it been unusually busy for you?
Yes. It has been this dichotomy of just being completely flattened and exhausted. I feel as if I've aged a few years in this one year, but also like thrilling. It's been one of the most exciting, amazing years from a professional standpoint, in that, you know, if you're sort of a market junkie, if you just love, frankly, the adrenaline of the markets, this is it, right? Like when I talked about fear expanding, fear, the cycles of fear and hope being more extreme this year, that's when you get your chance. And if you are, as I am, an investor that believes you have to wait for your price, you have to just figure out the companies you want and just wait and wait and wait, which is so hard. I have little kids, and one of the mantras in our house is, I know, waiting is not easy. There's a book called that. Right? You probably know the book. But you're just waiting. And so when you get this like big expansion and contraction in hope and fear, that's your chance.
There's so many questions coming in. And actually, I want to get to them. I did just want to ask you sort of on the cyclicals, does that mean materials? Does that mean there's appetite from China to look at commodities? I mean, give us a bit of a breakdown within there.
Yep. So the stuff that by the time we came out of the summer, so towards the end of the summer into the fall, and we were starting to really contend with election and valuation dispersion, which, as you've heard over and over from me again, is sort of like a core part of my process. And I think what makes my process unique, had gapped out. I was looking at the parts of the market that were still really dislocated. So you had this big recovery, but there was still a lot of dislocation that would allow you to just, you know, really own a lot of stocks that were interesting. So for me, it was airports, airport retailers. Like these things were down 30-40% even after last week, right? Which is pretty cool, in the sense that you still got tons of opportunity because the market's just not there yet. They need to see the evidence in order to get behind these stocks. And to me, the evidence is that science is solving this at an accelerating pace. I've been buying stuff related to travel, so travel booking systems. There's a really high quality company that was down like 50%. I've been buying physical retailers, apparel, some amount of luxury, beauty, event planning companies, things tied to gyms and casinos and karaoke. I mean, everything that is tied to people getting back to some amount of normalization. And part of that is confirmed by the efficacy of these vaccines being in the 90s, because I was worried that the base case was sort of 60s, and if it was in the 60s, the uptake would have been low. And a recent Gallup poll came out last night saying that the proportion of people that are willing to take a vaccine with an efficacy in the 90s is a lot higher. So sort of the herd immunity that we're going for will potentially happen sooner, which means you can get back to normalization sooner. And these stocks are still so dislocated. There's still stocks out there that are down 30-40%.
Right. And we all need karaoke to get back to normal too. I mean, obviously.
There are really good karaoke companies that are public in Japan.
I won't ask you what your song is, but no, it's important. Okay, questions. So many of them here, Ramona, for you. Okay. So we're again. Let's begin with the energy sector. Thoughts on the mm-hmm. energy sector. It's important to lots of investors. Canadians focus on it certainly. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts? Do you go near it or no?
So energy is still really dislocated, and I am coming out of March, energies just got clobbered, not just because of the pandemic. Both supply and demand got super dislocated, and it got caught, as we all know. So I started really increasing my energy exposure then and have kept it pretty high. It's still very dislocated. It's still super cheap. And alpha odds in energy are extremely tied to valuation because it's a deep cyclical without much capital discipline. So for deep cyclicals that, and you could argue energy is becoming more capital disciplined, but who knows? But certainly for deep cyclicals, you have to wait until they're really cheap, and they're pretty cheap. So that's my very simple way of thinking about energy. I own a lot of them, and I've continued to sort of buy them when they get a little bit more disciplined.
Okay, awesome.
So I sort of own refiners and integrated oil companies, such as the ones in Canada.
Right, okay. Are you expecting, as an advisor, a lot of volatility through next year? And, you know, a correction on the horizon is sort of part of the question.
Corrections, in my mind, depend on sort of what the market gives you, in the sense that if dispersion or valuation spreads just narrow a lot, then you'll have a valuation problem. And to me, valuation being too high is a risk, so that introduces the risk of correction. The way that I'm thinking about risk to sort of the recovery outlook, we still have a capacity issue with the treatment regimens and with the vaccines. So even though science is sort of solving it, it's not clear that there will be enough of it to really, you know, take care of large swaths of the population. So that means that you still have some amount of mitigation happening, some amount of economic activity that's suppressed, which means you still need a stimulus bridge. And to the extent that, say, the U.S. government doesn't provide that bridge in an adequate way, then you have the potential for a second dip, as they call it, recession. So that's kind of on my mind, but also to the extent that valuations in a large part of the market, such as the super growth stocks, the stocks that have led the market for several years now, get extra extreme, that could provide some risk. One thing that mitigates it a little bit is that the market has broadened out a lot in the last couple of weeks. So it's not necessarily that one set of companies are going up at the expense of another set, that there's a trade-off. It's that the whole market is broadening. And that's encouraging.
That's sort of a healthier sign. I just want to ask on the stimulus question, because, you know, it's talked about a lot. How do you look at stimulus as it gets involved with valuations, or does it get involved in valuations? Some will say because there's stimulus and companies have been able to borrow, maybe if they didn't need to borrow, it was cheap, so they could. Does that distort anything, or how do you put that into the way you look at valuation, if at all?
I mean, very simplistically, in a way, you know, the market had a hiccup early in the fall when the stimulus wasn't coming through in the U.S. So dispersion again opened up, which provided an opportunity to just buy economic sensitivity. So that's one way to think about market expectations around what the government is going to do. In terms of valuation, does it get into valuation or not? you could argue that if stimulus is big enough, so you have to kind of look, I think, long-term and short-term. So you could argue that if stimulus is big enough, that super economically sensitive stocks or cyclicals would just do a lot better, especially cyclicals that are levered, if you will, to whatever the stimulus. So it's infrastructure. A lot of industrials will do well, for instance, right? Or materials companies. So that kind of, and maybe value would get extended. But the issue with a lot of stimulus, when your starting point in sovereign balance sheet health is not so good. So sovereign balance sheets are a lot more levered, certainly coming out of this pandemic because they were used to solve the pandemic. So the issue with stimulus in the longer term is that you are sort of weakening your balance sheet. So it depends on how big it is, whether or not the markets would have a problem.
There are a number of different questions that touch on growth versus value, much of which you've been discussing, and breadth in the market, also small caps, is it their time? Are there many different lenses through which you look this? I think you start with valuation dispersion, as you say, but can you bring it down to growth versus value, or is that too broad of a categorization?
No, it's not. It's one categorization. So there are lots of different ways to try to measure dispersion, which is, as I said, a crucial part of my process, along obviously with the fundamental research that's coming up with ideas all over the world. So there's definitely sort of growthy stocks versus value. There's momentum versus low anti-momentum, negative momentum. There's like high beta versus low beta I look at. There's also market cap dispersion, and definitely what one of the questions is, which should be beneficial probably for like Steve McMillan, I think he runs small cap money, is small caps, the dispersion with large caps is still pretty wide. They are more economically cyclical. Sensitive, they're in the US at least, they are more domestically oriented. So definitely there's a cap bias right now. You could look at dispersion regionally, so like US versus non-US, that kind of thing, emerging versus developed. So what it often just comes down to is economically sensitive versus sort of stable and predictable, or what I call reliability versus economically sensitive. And that spread is still reasonably wide.
Is there anything that investors who are investing, obviously for income, just, you know, this is part of how they have crafted their portfolios and so on. What do they need to know going forward? What is sort of the outlook for income?
So income is more of an outcome of my process than a target. And so maybe I'll take a little bit of time to just do a quick recap of what I'm trying to do. So in all of my strategies, global and US dividend, I believe that they are all core strategies in that they're looking for a good return, a good investment return with lower than market volatility and a reasonable level of income. So what that essentially equates to is a strong risk-adjusted total return. And that's what we have delivered over almost a decade. So what that means is I'm looking for investment return, downside protection, and income. And the way I get there is I believe that valuation drives my investment return. You get what you pay. Price is very much tied to your ultimate return. Quality drives your downside protection, and quality also drives your income. So if I focus on valuation and quality, income is a natural outcome of that process. And the reason I put it that way is because income is actually not a good alpha factor. So to the extent you do care about excess term, you don't want to target income. You want it to fall out of the process. So the way that I approach income is I will only go after it when it's cheap. And so right now, a lot of the income in the market is in cyclical sectors. So financials, tons of income, materials, some industrials, discretionary. So to the extent that I have been over the last several months adding to those areas, right? So like US banks, there's still a lot of cheapness. They're fairly good quality, certainly relative to the last cycle, lots of income. The income profile of my strategies should be increasing because a lot of income in the market, again, is cheap.
So this, as you said, sort of off the top, this is your moment. Like this is sort of one of the moments of rotation that we've been talking about. There are still opportunities in your mind. How do you sort of want people to take something away from what you're doing right now through to, say, the end of the year into 2021?
So I don't know that this particularly is my moment. I don't mean to deny what you're saying. I also thought going into the pandemic was also an amazing moment from purely an investment perspective, because you just had so much dislocation that was potentially going to happen. So where I might be positioning all my strategies to just take advantage of a global recovery, back then I was positioning for a pretty big drawdown. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the year is one where you just have to be extremely flexible. And that's what really resonates with me. That's what's made it exciting. Not necessarily right now, adding a lot of, or having added, I should say, a lot of risk, or back then being really defensive, but just being able to just adapt to what the market is giving you. So going into, to your question, going into 2021, I think to the extent that dispersion still remains reasonable, so valuation spreads in sort of large cap US are like around 2 standard deviations, which is like okay for risk assets. Back in the pandemic, it was 4 to 5, so it's come in a lot. So you still have to be reasonably careful. But if you can look in sectors like energy, where valuation spreads are a lot wider than that, you should be able to do fairly well going into the next couple of years. You obviously need to have sort of a longer time horizon. But you also have to be vigilant because there's still some risks, right? It's not totally certain. So what I should say then is you still have to like adapt to what the market's giving you and continue to be really flexible.
It's so interesting. And here's a final question coming in now. You addressed it to an extent with US versus non-US, but the question is, Ramona, how do you look at currency in your process? Do you look at a US dollar being lower for longer? How does that fit in with the way that you look at opportunities globally?
So I don't explicitly take currency views. And you'll remember that both strategies, US and global, are the equity allocations in a multi-asset fund. The Canadian funds are multi-asset. So the lead managers, and I believe you had David Tulk on recently, who runs, who's one of the managers, they will make the currency allocation. So they will often explicitly, and I think he was talking about currency in that one where he was sort of anti-Canadian dollar and anti-US and more interested in risk assets, probably for the same reasons that I'm more interested in risk assets. So they will typically make the currency allocations, number one. Number two, there's also a currency neutral version of these strategies in case you don't want the currency exposure. So having said that, though, if you hear me saying that I'm more interested in non-US equities and emerging market equities, that would imply that I probably have a less constructive view on the US dollar, which is pretty typical in sort of a global recovery scenario.
Right. Oh, it's absolutely fascinating.
Especially when you have a central bank, especially when you have a central bank that is trying to be really constructive, I guess, or has explicitly said that they might not be as concerned with inflation as they have been in the past.
Right. Fascinating. Yes. Not even thinking about it. I think you said in one of the other webcasts, not even thinking.
Good memory. Wow.
Ramona, first off, thank you for joining us today. Great to see you again.
Nice to see you too.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.